Bill O'Reilly, Fox News, 400 Capitol Street Northwest, number 550, Washington, D.C., 20001. Dear Mr. O'Reilly, you got my attention with your recent program when you and other Fox News personalities announced that war had been declared on Christmas. Being a pastor of a church as well as a pretty big fan of Christmas, I wanted to share some of my thoughts. I understand the pain that comes whenever we discover something pure and hopeful and holy being threatened by callous and unthinking forces. When good and faithful people face the oppression of greed or self-serving dynasty's blind pursuit of power and domination, I know how it hurts to see tried and true allies renounce loyalties and join the opposition. It is important for all of us at such times to honor our instincts and hold on to what is holy. Indeed, many stories from the Bible lift up this obligation. I want to share one of those stories which describes the plight of the people who lived in Jerusalem just after the city was conquered by Alexander the Great. The Jews living there became civilians of an occupied territory ruled by a foreign king. Jerusalem, to this foreign kingdom, was an outpost not particularly important to rulers, and the Jews found that they could live and worship more or less as they pleased, as long as they paid their taxes. But then came Hellenization, the powerful sweeping influence of Greek culture. The Greeks, who were innovators in philosophy and mathematics and rhetoric, these ideas swept into the Jewish community, and before long, Judaism began to feel the impulse to change because of these influences, and Jewish authorities worried constantly about the future and the purity of their faith. Now, into this time came a new ruler by the name of Antiochus IV. Antiochus did not understand or particularly respect the Jews and insisted that all of them together practice Hellenistic customs like everyone else in the kingdom. So he took control of the main Jewish temple, smashed all their religious symbols and sacred oils, and converted the whole thing to Greek pagan worship. Surviving Jews were counseled to resist this influence, but it was too alluring and seductive to ignore. Many Jews wavered, and Jewish authorities lived with the anxiety of extinction, knowing that if people failed to carry on their customs, the faith would die, and the people would be assimilated. It was in this context of anxiety that a rebel Jewish leader, Matthias Maccabee, killed an apostate Jew for taking part in a pagan sacrifice in the temple. And then he killed the attending royal officer. Things escalated, a bloody battle ensued, and for years, guerrilla warfare followed. 3 long years later, Matthias' son, Judas Maccabee, led a sneak attack that overtook the temple, whereby a band of Jews rededicated it by recovering a single vial of sacred oil, which was only supposed to be enough to last one day, but it lasted for 8, until more oil could be consecrated. Mr. Riley, this is the miracle of Hanukkah, the story for which Jews remember the holiday each year. It is a story like the one you describe of your faith, which you feel is under fire by self-serving and oppressive forces. I also have a personal story of living under the seductive influence of an invading culture. I was born in the early 60s, just as television was assuming its place of prominence in American life. And with TV came the power of advertising. And it seemed like no aspect of American life became more of a target for advertisers than the celebration of Christmas, especially in regards to the ritual of gift giving. I was 5 years old when it first occurred to me that Christmas gift giving was not supposed to be a one-way gesture from parents to children, but an act of reciprocity, ways of exchanging love. This epiphany was made clear by my kindergarten teacher, who helped me and all of my classmates make Christmas presents for our parents. We made clay handprints. The one that I made is this one. And that all seemed fine until I started watching the TV commercials, none of which promoted clay handprints. They were all touting more elaborate gifts like jewelry or cars or bigger and better TVs. Still, I wrapped my gift and placed it under the tree. Everything was well and good until we started unwrapping presents. And one of the first presents that my mom opened was from my older brother, Doug, who was a year older than I was. He had gotten her a clay handprint the year before when he was in kindergarten. But this year, he upgraded significantly. And I watched as he handed my mom a big, heavy present. My mom unwrapped it and was speechless when she realized that my brother had gotten her a whole gallon of perfume. A whole gallon. Nothing says love like a gallon of perfume. And I felt so outdone and embarrassed that I hid my present to my mom, which she didn't find until we cleaned up all the Christmas decorations a week later. That event, Mr. O'Reilly, made quite an impression on me. For years, I carried the threat of being outdone at Christmas, and apparently, I wasn't the only one, because I noticed for years in my family that it became very predictable that one or more of us would, in our wild desperation to satisfy expectations, wind up getting one of those presents for someone with absolutely no cultural, relational, or intrinsic value, something that would only sell during the waning hours of Christmas Eve, something like a battery-operated plaque with a life-sized open-mouth bass singing, "We wish you a Merry Christmas." And more than once in my life, I vowed to resist this urge, remembering how every time such a gift was unwrapped, it left me with the emotional and spiritual equivalent of indigestion. But every year, I would see the commercials of extravagant presents where the husband's face would light up when he opens the little box that his wife gives him, discovering inside the keys to a brand new Lexus, which sat with a bow in the driveway. And I know part of my problem, Mr. O'Reilly, was that I never get the Lexus. I always get the singing fish. And as much as I hope it will be different, it never is. And it wasn't that I'm confused about what kind of people I hang out with at the holidays. It's clear to me that we are fish people, through and through. But sometimes it makes me wish we were something else. It may be, Mr. O'Reilly, that you never wished to be part of something other than what you already were, or have something other than what you already have. But there are a lot of people in this world who know that struggle intimately. Like comedian Lewis Black, who talked about the seductive influence that Christmas had on him and his Jewish family. He says it this way: "I have no religion now because I was raised Jewish. And when I was very young, on the first night of Hanukkah, my parents gave me a top to play with. They called it a dreidel. I knew it was a top. I showed my top to my friends next door, and they showed me the pony they just got for Christmas. And I looked at the top, and I looked at the pony. And I remember the moment I realized I wasn't going to be Jewish for very long. What Mr. Black describes is not just personal. His experience echoes the struggles of all Jewish people to stand against successive waves of cultural temptation. First, with the Hellenization, and then over the years with the seductive influence of Christmas. Do you remember when the image of Santa really began to sweep into prominence in this country? And many Jewish immigrants, eager to adapt to American culture, created Hanukkah Herman. And when Christmas trees were going up everywhere, Jewish families adapted to the Hanukkah bush. And to compete with the giant Christmas tree at Rockefeller Plaza, Jews in Tel Aviv actually created the world's largest menorah, more than 60 feet tall, weighing 17 metric tons. It was 600 square meters, and it was lit by a rabbi lifted up by a crane. But it's important to understand that it was never Christmas that these Jewish families wanted. It was the spectacle that came with Christmas, the lights, the festivity, the unbridled shopping spree that Christmas was becoming. It wasn't so much a matter of Jews succumbing to the temptations of Christmas as it was becoming mesmerized by the spectacle of Christmas wrapping itself in corporate commercialism. What seems to have occurred regarding Christmas over the last two generations in this country is akin to the Holy Family becoming grafted to a Christmas cash register, like the people in Star Trek encountering the Borg, until what emerges is a good impulse corrupted by a dominant agenda, reducing a message of hope into a call for assimilation. You will shop. Resistance is futile. Follow la la la, la 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 la. Now go buy the singing fish. Christmas is not being threatened by the dominant culture, Mr. O'Reilly. Christmas has become the dominant culture. And until you find a way to reclaim that once good and true spirit at the heart of the original message you were given, you will continue to just spout the doctrine of commercialism which has grafted itself to your soul. The struggle that you and Christmas have succumbed to is one still being resisted by all who endeavor to remain true to the underlying simple message that their faith has to offer. Rabbi Jeff Salkin, a colleague of mine in Atlanta, offered some great insight about this struggle. He said, "The Christmas season is an extremely seductive season for the Jews. While it is delightful to be able to enjoy the festive nature of this season, Hanukkah reminds us that there are times when we must stand apart from the majority religious culture. The real miracle of Hanukkah," he continues, "is not that a small army of Jewish loyalists were able to defeat the most powerful army in the world. The real miracle of Hanukkah is that Judaism was able to stand up to the tempting culture of its time. You seem to have lost that battle, Mr. O'Reilly. And in losing sight of your original faith, you seem set on a course of trying to assimilate others into giving up theirs. I'm not sure what promise convinced you to give up a message of light and hope and love for one of arrogance and greed and hate, but I take heart in knowing there remain good Christians, even good non-Christians, who have remained true to the original Christmas message. I know there are whole towns of them. This year marks the 20-year anniversary of evidence to that fact. 20 years ago in Billings, Montana, a brick was thrown through 5-year-old Isaac Schnitzer's bedroom window. He woke up covered in shards of glass. The reason? A menorah was stenciled on the front window of the family's home to help them celebrate Hanukkah. Now, Billings, Montana is considered a homeland for the Aryan Nation, Klan members, and other white supremacists, and hundreds of hate crimes occur there every year, many against Jews, the desecration of Jewish cemeteries, threatening phone calls to Jewish citizens, and swastikas painted on the homes of Jewish families. When Isaac's mother, Tammy Schnitzer, asked the police how she could best protect her family from harm, the advice she got was to remove the symbols. She was shocked. How would she explain this to her son, she asked. When she heard, neighbor Margaret McDonald was deeply touched by this question. She tried to imagine explaining to her children that they couldn't have a Christmas tree in their window or a wreath on their door because it wasn't safe. She remembered what happened when Hitler ordered the King of Denmark to force Danish Jews to wear the Star of David. The order was never carried out because the king himself and many other Danes chose to wear the yellow stars themselves, and so the Nazis lost their ability to find their enemy. So Mrs. McDonald phoned her pastor at the First Congregational United Church of Christ and asked what he thought of having Sunday school children make paper cutout menorahs for their own windows. He got on the phone with colleagues, and soon menorahs appeared in the windows of hundreds of Christian homes. Asked about the danger of this action, Police Chief Wayne Einman told callers, "I think there's actually a greater risk in not doing it." 5 days after the brick was thrown at the Schnitzer's home, the Gazette published a full-page drawing of a menorah along with a general invitation for people to place it in their windows. By the end of the week, nearly 10,000 homes had them displayed. A sporting goods store got involved, advertising on a large billboard the words, "Not in our town. No hate, no violence. Peace on earth." Someone shot at it. People of other faiths and no faiths at all took turns holding vigils outside the synagogue during Sabbath services. Then bricks and bullets turned on the windows at Central Catholic High School, where an electric marquee read, "Happy Hanukkah to our Jewish friends." Windows were broken out at the United Methodist Church because of its menorah display. Car and house windows of 6 non-Jewish families were shattered, some with notes which read, "Jew lover." Eventually, the violence waned, but not the love. People continued in their efforts to support one another against hate crimes, even after all of the holidays passed. During Passover the following spring, 250 Christians joined their Jewish brothers and sisters in a traditional Seder meal, celebrating the new friendships which had formed between them. To this day, Billings, Montana people still put up their menorahs to affirm the commitment to peace and religious tolerance. the light they kindled that first year, the light which maybe should have only burned brightly for that 1 year, has continued to burn for the last 20. People began living the true message of the holidays instead of all the hype. They banded together. They rekindled hope. The same is possible for you, Mr. O'Reilly. I have learned a lot as I have faced the temptations from a dominant culture to sell out my faith and buy into the myth that hope and happiness are actually for sale. I have worked hard to understand the love that can go into a clay handprint and the courage of giving yourself away to the people that you love, and the faith of knowing that others will recognize that gesture and surround you with joy. I know the people I hang out with at the holidays and all year round are fish people through and through. We'll never get a Lexus with a bow. But I also know that there is no place a Lexus could take us that has half the love we feel when we turn on that open mouth bass and sing together, "We wish you a Merry Christmas." The same is possible for you, Mr. O'Reilly. I don't know what dominant influence swept over you and stole your heart, but if you search your soul, I believe you can find a light. You may worry that it's only enough light to burn for one day, but have faith and surround yourself with others who have that light, and you might understand the miracle that it will be enough. Happy holidays, Mr. O'Reilly. Oh, and one more thing. Please do not invoke the word war when talking about Christmas. You, Mr. O'Reilly, are not a veteran. You have not earned that right. And you cheapen the sacrifices made for that word when you attach it to your frivolous cause. Sincerely, Reverend Greg Ward, Manassas, Virginia.